KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Great to have you here. Governor Jay Inslee is right now giving a news conference about how the Republican health care bill is going to affect Washington State. The governor says about 600,000 people would lose coverage if this bill rolls back the Medicaid expansion, and that another 100,000 people would drop out of Washington State's health care exchange. Well, we have an expert here. Aaron Katz teaches health policy at the... Yes, you are an expert. Don't pretend you're not. You're looking humble. He teaches health policy at University of Washington. You led the UW's health policy analysis program. How do those numbers sound?
Well,
700,000 people
right,
out of coverage.
I think from what we know, from our experience in the healthcare system in this country, which is insurance-based, and what happened... What we saw before the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, and what happened as a result of the Affordable Care Act, these numbers seem reasonable. That is, if you take away Medicaid coverage for low-income people and you fairly dramatically reduce the subsidies that people have to go out and buy individual insurance, as well as some other changes that the Republicans are proposing, a lot more people will be uninsured. I think that's true.
And why would the Republican plan that they've been running on for years now, all through President Obama's terms, why would the Republican health care offering be something that takes away so many subsidies and gets so many people kicked off coverage? I mean, is there a better case for this bill that we should hear?
Well, first of all, I think this is the first time. I mean, I know that the Republicans voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act, 48 yeah. times or whatever it was. But they never articulated a unified proposal. So back then, prior to this year, it was a little hard to know what they were proposing. Now we know at least one plan, the plan that the House Republicans have put together. And I would say it's primarily focused on a couple of things. Okay, one is reducing the amount of money the federal government spends on medical care. And they do that by rolling back the expansion of Medicaid and greatly reducing the amount of subsidies for low income, for people buying individual insurance. And that's consistent with at least one strain of Republicans in Congress who would like to see a lesser role of government in our lives.
And a lower debt.
Exactly. So it certainly does that. And it increases the financial responsibility of placed on individuals if they want to get medical care, if they want to get medical insurance and they want to get medical care. And that's also consistent with an ideology that has been expressed by at least some Republicans that people should have more, quote, skin in the game. Because if they if it's their money their money that's at stake when they decide whether or not to go to the hospital or to the doctor, they'll make, the theory goes, better economic decisions. And just like in the marketplace for shoes or cornflakes, those better decisions will result in a better system.
Can President Trump's promise that everybody's going to get coverage, you'll love it, options will go up, premiums will go down, is that realistic in that Republican world of increased choice and competition?
Well, I think the Republicans, as I've heard over the last couple of days since this bill has been formally proposed, have acknowledged that fewer people are going to be insured. So I don't think this bill fulfills the president's tweet about everybody being covered. I don't think that's the case. Their argument that more people that people are going to have more choices, I suppose that's true, because this frees up the insurance market and in fact induces the insurance market to greatly increase the number of possible plans with different benefits and different cost sharing provisions like deductibles and co-payments, different services offered. I think that's also true. People will have more choices, but it's not a choice necessarily that will be affordable for many people.
We have a question from a listener. Peggy McRae wants to know whether this Republican health care bill would make her Medicare more expensive. So we talk mostly about Medicaid expansion. What about Medicare?
Right. So the CBO, the Republican plan repeals essentially all of the taxes that supported the Affordable Care Act. That's what it would do. And two of those taxes provided funding for the Medicare Trust Fund. And so, in fact, made the trust fund healthier over a longer period of time. Repealing those taxes, of course, would have the opposite effect and put the Medicare Trust Fund in greater jeopardy sooner. What effect that would have on Medicare would depend on Congress's decisions, future decisions.
Right.
So, for example, they could decide that in order to make the trust fund more secure, we have to increase the premiums on Medicare beneficiaries. So that's one possibility. But we don't know that. Mm. That's in the future.
Here's another one. A listener named Jennifer wants to know what the effect of this new health care bill would be on kids, including possible cuts to CDC vaccine programs. She says here in Washington, 1 in 2 kids is covered by Medicaid. I didn't know that. 1 in 2?
Right. So two pieces of that. So one is the direct effects of the bill if it were to be enacted and implemented. And then that is the rollback of the expansion of Medicaid and the cuts to state funding for Medicaid. And what the CBO projects is that as a result of the cuts in the federal contribution to Medicaid, states would likely reduce eligibility. So more people, including children, would likely lose coverage as a result. The other effect is really indirect. It's not so much the American Health Care Act as the proposals, particularly from the administration, to greatly cut domestic discretionary spending, which includes everything from the State Department and foreign aid to CDC funding and the like.
Back to, by the way, we're talking with Aaron Katz, who teaches health policy at University of Washington. We started out talking about the take from Washington state leaders, our governor, our insurance commissioner. And Governor Inslee says it'll cost $1.3 billion to pay for the same amount of Medicaid in our state without help from the federal government. But what's wrong with that? Why doesn't Washington state, every federal taxpayer lives in a state. If the states need to raise taxes because those benefits are so important to the state's taxpayers, why shouldn't the states pay?
So, from a political science point of view, it's a reasonable question to ask. So, setting aside any questions about the type of tax, where the taxes go, who makes decisions about those taxes, yes, theoretically, if the federal government just said, well, we're just going to give Washington State all of that tax money that we are otherwise spending, okay, the state could, and just went into the coffers of the state could pay for care itself. The thing is that the state has its own limitations on how much money it can generate. So as we know, in Washington state, we don't have an income tax.
Right.
So, and we know that a big part of the tax base for the federal government is an income tax.
The income tax.
As well as some other taxes that the state doesn't have. Mm. We know the political challenges in this state of trying to get an income tax.
And pay for education.
And pay for education. So that's the second part of it. So one of us is a structural thing. We don't have the type of taxes that would likely be able to backfill, just wouldn't be able to produce the amount of money to backfill. But the second is probably even more important, and that is, as we know, the state legislature is grappling with how do we fund education, which is a requirement that the state Supreme Court has put on the legislature and has been estimated at $3 to $4 billion. Yeah. So now we're asking the state to find another $1 billion onto that. It's just politically untenable, I think.
Final question, Aaron Katz. This is not the final plan. So what is let's pick one. What is a most realistic window where listeners right now have a chance to lobby their politicians, they're members of Congress, and see change before the final plan.
Well, there's two points, decision-making points that are important for us right now. So one is this is a plan that has not yet reached the House floor.
Right.
Okay, so the House has to vote on it. So our congressional representatives in this state will have a voice. And so that's one point. If you have some views about this, contact your congressperson. And then, of course, secondly, if this plan were to pass the House, it goes to the Senate. And we have two senators.
Yeah. But is there one thing that is being horse traded right now that listeners could say, it's the subsidies, it's the speeding up of the Medicaid expansion phase. It's the something. Here's where I have sway, and I'm going to use it.
Well, I don't know what's being horse traded right now.
Okay.
But so you could choose one thing. If you had to choose one thing, it could be the Medicaid expansion. It could be the subsidies. Any of those.
Okay. Yeah. This is the part where the citizens have a say.
This is the messiness of American politics.
It's happening right now. Right. And that's Aaron Katz leading us through it. He teaches health policy at the University of Washington. Thanks for your insights. Will you come back and follow this with us?
I will absolutely come back. It's a pleasure.
Excellent. My pleasure. KUOW, listener-supported KUOW. Back with more of The Record in a moment. KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. First come, first served. That's the law now if you're trying to find an apartment in Seattle or if you're a landlord with an apartment to rent. Thanks to the law passed last summer, first of its kind in America, landlords cannot thumb through a stack of applications and choose the tenant they like the most. They've got to rent to the first qualified applicant. One of my guests now says that law helps renters get treated equally. John Grant ran the Tenants Union in Seattle. He's a candidate for Seattle City Council. Welcome, John.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And Chris Bennis is a landlord in Seattle and says finding the right tenant it's like dating or a job interview. You want the right person, not the first person. And he's part of the group suing the city over this new law. Chris, welcome.
Thank you very much.
First, Chris, why is it so important to choose who you rent to? If they meet the financial requirement, what's the issue?
The real issue is that the typical relationship between a landlord and tenant isn't like taking a box of soap off the shelf at Safeway and just walking out the door. You're building a relationship, hopefully one that's going to last for years, and you want to be able to find the right fit. Yes, I agree that there needs to be laws against discrimination and things like that, but there are a lot of subjective factors that are just practical issues between residents and property owners.
Like what? What are those subjective factors?
Well, typically, I don't have somebody come to the door and say, I want to rent today. I got my suitcases in my hand. They might say, I'm looking for a place next week or next month or 2 months from now. And so by creating this big pipeline of everybody rushing to be first in line, you've got this I don't know what the word is, this big group of people who are all wanting to rent today, but they may not need the place today. It doesn't work with the typical experience I've had renting properties in the city of Seattle. Most people say, they'll also say things like, boy, this is a nice place, but, would it cost more or less if you replace the carpet or didn't replace the carpet? Or I can live with it right now. Would the rent be any cheaper? All of that negotiation goes out the window if we're just saying this is a commodity, that a tenant walks up to the door, I'm first in line, I want it. All that goes out the window.
John Grant, what about that? The landlord's ability to negotiate with individual renters who have different desires?
Well, I think it's really important to note that this law did not get created in a vacuum. Just a year ago, the city of Seattle charged 23 large property owners for housing discrimination. And when the Seattle Office of Civil Rights did a study, they actually found that 60% of the landlords that they tested had evidence of fair housing violations. So I just want to kind of paint a picture here about what the real issue. Let's say you have two tenants that apply for a unit. One is a white woman and another is a woman who has an Arabic name and is wearing a hijab. Now, if that landlord is considering those two folks for an application before this law was passed, they might be subject to the implicit bias of that landlord, and maybe they're more comfortable renting to someone that looks more like them. So as a result of that, we were seeing that the fair housing and anti-discrimination laws were essentially pretty toothless without this new protection in place.
Would that hijab discrimination?
That's why the first in time legislation is so important, so that the first qualified applicant, regardless of what they look like, can get that housing.
And that you'd use the example of a hijab. Is that kind of discrimination legal now?
No, it is not. So under the City of Seattle's anti-discrimination laws, you're protected based on your race, your religion, your national origin. But if you do not have that kind of protection that the first-in-time legislation permits, what's to stop a landlord from kind of going through a stack of applicants and choosing the applicant that they're, you know, perhaps being biased towards? And I think
legal but not okay? I mean, the hijab example, that we have laws about that. So how do you think people are discriminated in currently that you can change that?
So we live in the Donald Trump era where casual racism is becoming a norm. And I think the city should do everything that it can to prevent folks from being denied housing based on their race, their religion, or any other protected class. And that's what first-in-time legislation does. It requires the first qualified applicant, regardless of how they look or where they come from, to get housing. And I think my question to Chris is, what is it about someone's looks that should determine if they have housing?
Is it their looks that you're evaluating, Chris?
Absolutely not. But like I said, you know, I have like some single family homes that I rent, for example, and some people might come to me and say, gee, is it okay if I plant flowers in the yard, or I love to garden? And there's a lot of reasons that are not discriminatory for which I might prefer one resident over another. Again, I'm trying to build a long-term relationship. And as long as I'm not engaging in a discriminatory practice on those protected class bases, which I agree with John on, should be prohibited, there's a lot that goes into this. You know, the thing about my particular property is I don't own it. It's owned by my three children, ages 13, 14, and 15. It's their college fund. This isn't Simon Legreed here, you know. My wife and I just took my kids' college fund and we bought them a little six-unit apartment building. But we want to manage it for their benefit.
Isn't John right, though, that over time, the old law allowed landlords to, let's say it's to discriminate against somebody who doesn't speak English well, or like vulnerable people who are in trouble if they're subject to the whims of, as John said, maybe even an implicit bias that you're not aware of as a landlord.
I have two responses to that. First of all, I know that Jonathan, who I'm well acquainted with, is running for city council. When he picked his campaign manager, I wonder if he just went to the first qualified applicant, or did he find somebody who was a good fit for him when he was hiring somebody for something critical? What I'm saying is most of the folks like myself, in my case, it's my kids' college fund. We have retired people, though, in rental houses, and they need that money, and they need a long-term tenant. They need a good relationship. And this ordinance steps in the middle of all of that and just presumes that all landlords are acting out of bad motivations. And I think that's just flat out wrong.
John,
so I guess I want to point out that this is not about, you know, whether Chris is a good landlord or about me. This is about the city conducting a test of landlords and finding that 60% of the time there is evidence of discriminatory practices. So this is not coming out of the air. This is a real problem that the city was trying to address. And the first come, first serve legislation is the most equitable way to address the kind of discrimination that it does exist right here in Seattle, as progressive a city as it is.
Chris, you are a plaintiff in this lawsuit against the city with landlords. And one of the claims in the lawsuit is that this new law passed in this last summer will harm the availability of housing in the city. Why would that be?
Well, the truth of the matter is that this is an incredibly complicated law. One of the reasons that we deferred filing a lawsuit is just to figure out how the city was going to interpret the law. There are so many people who, as rental property owners, don't know how to comply with it, that people are going to be chased out of providing rental housing. Now,
well, it sounds super simple to comply with. First come, first serve.
No, because you have to have very specific rental criteria and you have to publish them. You couldn't just take your little 3x5 card and put it on the bulletin board at your church saying apartment for rent. You have to list what all your rental criteria are when you do any advertising. If you have a website, it has to link directly to your rental criteria. I've developed a rental criteria that is 4 pages long. You know,
So you've upped your requirements on the front end to shape that who a qualified applicant is.
Exactly. And I'm not using just things like rental criteria in terms of income or credit score. I'm going, were you on time to the showing appointment? Did you take your shoes off when you came in to view the place? Mm. Because I'm trying to get to all those subjective things that I look to when I'm interviewing a prospective tenant. Whether all landlords are going to do that, I don't know. But yeah, that's why my criteria is now 4 pages long.
If I can jump in there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of the very last thing that Chris said there, is that I don't know what other landlords are doing. And I think that that's what this is trying to get at. Not all landlords are good actors. And I think that we have to have legislation and regulation to make sure that people are treated equally. That's what the heart of this legislation is. It's that making sure that people who are perfectly qualified to be good tenants get treated equally. And this is what the legislation accomplishes, where before there was a huge loophole where, you know, somebody could just pick and choose between applicants based on their protected class status. And I think that is really the problem. And I think it's important to point out, too, that the Rental Housing Association itself, which Chris is a part of, this is the landlord, you know, lobbying group. They testified saying that first come, first serve is the best practice to prevent a discrimination complaint against the landlord. So they themselves said that this is actually the best practice for landlords to follow.
Jonathan, we look at people who come to the door and look at a place on the first come, first serve basis. But when we're looking at them, we still use subjective factors. And those things, as long as they're not discriminatory, are fair game. At least that's the way we believe it is. And that's the way I would like to see it remain. And there's a reason why this is a first. There's no other law like this anywhere in the United States. This is unprecedented, the idea of taking the rental housing decision entirely out of the landlord's hands.
We're getting close to the end here. You said that you think this will harm the availability of housing. If this law stands, will you get out of the landlord business?
The fact of the matter is, I have two small rental properties in the city of Seattle, a 6-unit and a 3-unit, and both of them are listed for sale right now. And because of this law.
John, any reaction? Whatever the merits for renters, do you think this will mean fewer owners renting out their properties?
I think that it's pretty implausible that landlords would sell a huge asset like an entire apartment complex simply because they're being asked to treat people equally. Seattle needs to be an equitable place where everyone can live, and this is a law that furthers for housing laws and furthers protects tenants, and it's the right thing to do.
Okay, so we have this lawsuit. Again, Chris Bennis is a Seattle landlord, part of a group suing the city over this requirement that he rent on a first-come, first-served basis. And what happens next with the lawsuit? Where are we on this?
It's been filed with the court. I'm not the attorney who's handling the case. And, you know, typically in King County, a case takes a year and a half. So
year and a half.
Moving forward for a while.
Okay, I gave Chris the first word. John Grant, former executive director of the Tenants Union and Seattle City Council candidate. Any final words on this law and the challenge to it?
I think that there is a huge imbalance of power between landlords and tenants, and this is a very reasonable, modest proposal to make sure that we can have a rental market where people are not discriminated against. And I think that it's even in the landlord's interest to make sure that laws like this are upheld. So I'm disappointed that the landlords filed this lawsuit, but I think ultimately it will lose in court because fair housing laws have been upheld many times before. Because, again, it's the right thing to do to treat people equally.
We'll watch. John Grant, Chris Bennis, thanks for having a good discussion about this, the pros and cons of this law and the challenge to it. Thank you. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Bye, Chris. KUOW's The Record, listener-supported radio at 94.9 FM. And there's more to come. News from Canada and more. Stick around. Immigrant labor built the Puget Sound region. It is part of the story of growth and development here. Now, there are a lot of ways to tell that history, and how you tell it signals who belongs and who's an outsider in that story, who's a foreigner. This is true in Black Diamond, an old mining town about to become home to a large housing development. It's known for its Welsh heritage and Irish heritage, but that's not the whole story. For KUOW's Region of Boom team, reporter Joshua McNichols brings you the story of Black Diamond's hidden Asian American history.
And one cherry fritter and one apple fritter.
Ask anyone if they've been to Black Diamond, and they're likely to mention the bakery. It's a place that everyone stops at when they go skiing at Crystal Mountain. The bakery first opened in 1902, and it's still going strong.
Good. Good.
Thank you so much. And I'll slice your bread for you.
Okay.
And this is the bread. This is 115 years old recipe we are using it, the Crystal Mountain bread.
I got one of everything that I didn't get last time.
Right.
Moon Bang bought the iconic bakery about 10 years ago. She became the guardian of its 115-year history. To some people, that seemed incongruous.
They said, you need to go home. It was a shock.
And where was home anyway? Once Bang lived in South Korea, where she worked for the government. But women weren't expected to have careers. She came here instead. Eventually, she became a U.S. citizen, so this was her home. She spent almost two decades running a dry cleaners in Auburn so she could send her two daughters to a private Christian school. When the Black Diamond Bakery came on the market, it just felt right.
It's quiet country and nice view. Yes.
She and her husband threw themselves into it. They added dinner and evening jazz performances. Even 10 years later, they still work until midnight most nights, ordering food and prepping stuff. If a baker calls in sick or something breaks, they stay all night.
Yeah, spend the night. Sometimes 2 days we didn't sleep, nothing.
So when people told her she didn't belong in Black Diamond, it stung. On the outside, she held her composure and smiled.
I was even inside, I have to crying and mad. I have to holding my breath.
People have been telling Asian Americans they didn't belong in this part of King County for a long time. The seeds of that resentment go back to at least the 1870s. That's when Chinese workers helped to build the railroad spurs serving the county's coal mines. Here's local archaeologist Ben Bronson.
One of the big advantages of Chinese laborers compared to their white competitors is they didn't get drunk on weekends.
Alcohol was a big problem in mining towns, especially among the white workers.
If you were an American contractor who are hiring white laborers, you had to worry about the fact you wouldn't get anything done on Monday because everybody would still be asleep.
Bronson says that and other things led unions to resent the Chinese. In 1882, the U.S. banned Chinese laborers from coming into the country. Bronson's partner is archaeologist Shui Mei Ho. She tells the story of what happened to Chinese railroad workers after they were hired as miners in Black Diamond.
A group of Chinese, they live together. You know, they all live in one big house. And according to the newspaper reports,
unidentified assailants set fire to the house. The archaeologists I talked to think it's pretty clear it was probably union workers. These kinds of things happened all over the West as anti-Chinese sentiment grew. Black Diamond avoided the worst of the bloodshed.
The building was burned down, but the Chinese managed to escape in time, so no one was hurt.
But even with the Chinese workers chased out of Black Diamond, there were still traces of their presence. Rose Murdoch grew up in Black Diamond. As we speak on the phone, she and I both open Google Maps and fly over the house in Black Diamond where she grew up.
You know where the cul-de-sac is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a drop-off there that goes down into a gully. And there was a big train trestle track, you know, all made out of wood crisscrossed, how they used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he just said that the Chinese worked on the railroads and that two of them were buried in that field. And he didn't know what happened to them, but he just said that, you know, he was told that they were buried there.
But those Chinese workers are probably gone now. Their bodies would have been dug up and returned to China. That was written into their labor contracts and was taken very seriously. Rahul Gupta of the Wing Luke Museum says that common practice partly explains how we can sometimes undervalue the role Asian Americans played in growing and developing our region.
In Western culture, you put a headstone, right? You put a headstone and you have people remember you. Well, that's how you make a mark if you passed away in an area, if you settled. Well, it's not the way it worked for at least the Chinese population. They were exhuming their bodies so they could have proper burials in China.
And it wasn't just the Chinese. Sikhs also helped build the region's railroads. Filipinos worked the land. Japanese Americans also had a major presence in the Green River Valley between Black Diamond and Auburn. They owned berry farms. Jean Beers was their neighbor.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. It's kind of sad to see them all gone.
It's easy to forget the history and how Asian Americans helped grow and develop the region because the record is so ephemeral as memory and some pieces of paper. How we remember that history influences how we see someone like Moon Bang, who bought the Black Diamond Bakery, and whether she belongs.
Well, I'm American citizen too. I'm here for, you know, working and pay tax. You know, I'm a little shorter and then little have a accent. You know, why we have to have that kind of, you know, discrimination.
But people are coming around. Remember the customers who didn't like her? At least one of them changed their mind.
One people came and apologized to. Yes.
What did they say?
They said, I'm sorry, but I didn't know you. And then you are really working hard and then really changed the bakery. And, you know, from now I can come, they said.
They could come and be a customer again.
Oatmeal fudge bar, a chocolate eclair, and a macaroon brownie, and one of everything.
For KUOW's Region of Boom team, I'm Joshua McNichols in Black Diamond.
It all looks wonderful.
And you will find more of KUOW's reporting on the growth of Black Diamond, the pros and cons. It's all up at KUOW.org. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. How'd you like to open up the New York Times and see your local government described as the Wild West of political cash? That happened in January to people in British Columbia, and there's been quite a reaction. Joining us from the Wild West of British Columbia, the host of CBC Radio's On the Coast, Stephen Quinn. Howdy.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So campaign contributions that are illegal across Canada are okay in British Columbia?
That is pretty much the case. Well, five provinces and two territories in the country have election laws that prohibit corporations and trade unions and any foreign interests from donating to election campaigns. Here in BC, we have no such thing. It really is the Wild West. Any corporation can give as much money as they want. Any union can give as much money as they want. And foreign money, well, we'll happily take it, I guess, if you're a political party here in this province.
Well, what's so free and easy about British Columbia? Why is it that way?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about it over the past few years. You know, it's fundamentally undemocratic when you look at it, because people who can afford to contribute to political parties might expect that they'll get something in return. Our premier is very fond of hosting very exclusive $10,000 a plate fundraisers for the very wealthy, very influential business people of this community. And of course, that doesn't exactly create a level playing field. Why is it the way it is? I suppose because it's always been this way, Bill. And when you're the government that's banked $12 million over the last year and $30 million over the last 3 years, not a lot of incentive to change that, I think.
Well, we have some political influence here from donors as well. You'll be surprised to know. But what is it that critics say is the terrible effect of all this? I mean, do you see rampant corruption in BC?
No, we don't. But what it does is it casts doubt over the government's decisions and why it makes the decisions it does. I'll give you an example. The Greater Vancouver Taxi Association is a big contributor to the BC Liberal Party, the government party. We are now talking about introducing Uber into Vancouver, finally. And what the provincial government has done is it said it's going to give $1 million to the taxi association to spend on developing an app for cabs so those cabs can compete when Uber comes online. You know, that's just one example of, after giving over tens of thousands of dollars toward an election effort for the BC Liberals, I don't know, could you draw the line and say maybe they're getting something back in return? But that suspicion hangs over everything that happens in this province now. You know, when you've got developers dropping $400,000 in political contributions in a single day and then getting developments approved or getting tax breaks on development, people get really suspicious about it.
And I hadn't known that rich donors can give to the party, the Liberal Party of British Columbia Premier Christy Clark, and the party can give some of that money directly to Premier Clark. It's hers to keep.
Well, she's finally put an end to that now, and this was to do with those big fundraisers. The premier, it turns out, was taking a $50,000 a year stipend, and that was for her work as leader of the BC Liberal Party. She's finally put an end to that because, I mean, think about the optics of it. You host a fundraiser with a bunch of corporate leaders, a bunch of CEOs. They donate a certain amount of money to the party, and you skim $50,000 a year off that. You know, you don't need a very complicated flowchart to figure out where that money is coming from and where it's going. I mean, it's going from those corporate donors into the premier's personal bank account.
So I understand there's a lot of reaction. I don't know if it's just because of the New York Times story or if this was going on anyway, but how are BC politicians reacting to criticism of this?
Well, it's interesting because now the premier has struck this commission and she just announced this on Monday. The Liberals, until this week, were completely unrepentant about this. They saw nothing wrong with the system. Anytime you said, you know, is that really fair? Does that really serve democracy well? The answer was, yes, it's absolutely fine. This week, 2 months out from a provincial election, the premier turned around and said she's going to strike a commission after the election in May to take a look at finally reforming electoral finances in this province to bring them in line with what most other provinces and territories in this country have done.
So, Stephen, is this considered a big scandal or political liability for the Liberal Party such that British Columbia might have Liberal politicians thrown out of office?
I don't know, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's not sitting well with a lot of voters, but we're a fairly divided partisan province. And so I would imagine that people who support Christy Clark and the BC Liberals don't see anything that wrong with it. We're all free to support the political party of our choice. But certainly on our radio show, when we open up the phone lines and when we hear our talkback calls, man, people are really, really upset about this and think that it's undemocratic. They think it's unfair. The word corrupt does get thrown around a lot. I don't know what it's going to mean at the polls, and I don't know whether it's going to stick. But we're seeing a lot of these late-in-the-game reversals from this provincial government as we get closer to this election.
Okay. The host of CBC's Radio on the Coast, Stephen Quinn, watching the tumbleweeds go by in the Wild West of British Columbia. Nice American Italian spaghetti Western reference.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Quinn, thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye, Bill.